My name's Chris Kirk, and this is TW Talks, the interviews podcast from Free Weeks Edinburgh. I am at the Edinburgh Festival 2025. I'm sitting in the club bar at Assembly George Square, right at the heart of the fringe, and I'm going to be talking to performers who are appearing at this year's festival, talking past, present, and future, their journey in comedy to date, this year's show, and what is happening next. Today, Ismail Lutfi, whose show Heavenly Baba is on at Assembly George Square this festival. Let's get TW talking with Ismail. So we are back in the club bar at Assembly with the fringe happening all around us, hopefully not too close. Who knows if we'll get some background noise. Sometimes we do. I have my next guest here. Ismail Lutfi has joined me. I saw his show 2 days ago. I loved it, which is why I've asked him to come and tell me about, the show. But past, present and future is our format. So before we get onto this year's show, maybe we'll say hello. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
And good to be here. Tell me about your journey into comedy. Now, you do talk about this in the show, so I know a little bit about it already.
Yes.
But just tell us, at what point in your life did you decide that comedy was the career you wanted to
see? I think I was 16. I was in high school, secondary school, as you call it.
We do.
And I felt very isolated. I was a very strange kid for reasons that I explained in the show. But stand-up just seemed like a way into making friends and communicating with people and connecting with people. And so when I was around 16, I just became fully invested in stand-up and watching it and thought about performing it. Began as a fan. I was a huge fan of like Zach Galifianakis and David Cross and Louis C.K., R.I.P., and these guys. And I learned kind of from the way that they would communicate with an audience how you should communicate with people. And then when I went to school, I would tell people, I'm going to be a comedian when I graduate. I'm going to be a comedian. And in a weird way, that made people think I was funny. Yes, you tell them that I'm going to be a comedian, and they go, oh, I guess you are kind of funny. Yeah, okay, I could see that. And then it's sort of you're manufacturing this consent that people are going to go, yeah, he's a funny guy because he's going to be a comedian. And from there, I had some crazy things happen over the next 2 years. I got married when I was 17. We talk about it in the show.
Talk about in the show.
And then got divorced when I was 18. And entering uni as a divorcee, it felt so appropriate. I should be a comedian now. I should actually do it.
And so you grew up in Florida.
Grew up in Florida, Central Florida. Yeah.
And so in a Muslim family in post 9/11 Florida, which is something you talk about very much in the show.
Yes.
And then where did you study at university?
I studied political science with the somewhat far off intention of maybe being a lawyer. That was kind of the idea. Maybe I'll be a lawyer. I was always very political, and I enjoyed learning about the political philosophies and the different outlooks. And so that was kind of the idea. And I talked to a guidance counselor when I was 18, and I told her I'm doing comedy, and I'm scared because it could be a huge failure, it could be nothing. And she told me, and I think about it all the time, she told me, do it for 10 years, and in 10 years you'll be 28. And if it doesn't work out, you'll still be young. You can still go into law. You can do whatever you want. And so I said, great. And from there, I just decided I'm going to go full in into comedy and did it for 2 more years. Finally told my parents, and they were surprisingly very accepting of it. They were. My mother is a white woman, so that kind of lent itself to being a little bit more accepting of a career in the arts than maybe a brown or Arab or Indian mother. But my white mom, she said, go for it. I love you. I'm proud of you. Get your degree. Please get your degree.
Have that backup.
Yes, just have your degree. So I got my degree. I'm in student loan debt because of it. And which is that a thing here, student loan debt?
Well, you say here, not in Scotland, but in
not
England.
In Scotland.
Yes.
Oh, do they have like a
different system in Scotland? Yes.
God. you guys have it all figured out.
England, we not quite at the level of the US.
Not
plenty of student debt in England.
America, there's like $300 trillion student debt. It's insane. Luckily, I don't have that much. I actually paid it off. But so then I finished school, and I had been pursuing comedy the whole time I was in college. I was a big loser doing open mics in Gainesville, Florida, which is a tiny college town. And then from there, I moved to Atlanta. Bigger city, bigger scene. Became kind of a professional comedian, working the clubs, working the road a little bit. And then from there, everything kind of took off. I did Just for Laughs. I got on television and, have been enjoying some success for the past 5 or 6 years.
So
it's been 15 years altogether, the whole journey. But you know.
So you mentioned some of the sort of comedy heroes who were watching as a fan before you decided this is what you were going to do. In terms of once you started doing, the open mic nights as the starting point, was it immediately obvious to you what your stand-up was going to be like? Or did it take a little bit of sort of deciding how you were going to present?
Because when you first start, I mean, everything is based on sort of your perspective, right? And when you started as an 18-year-old, you get a leg up in a way because you're starting so young, so you're really getting to inculcate your brain in this world. But the downside is you're 18, so you don't have anything to say. And your jokes are completely half-baked. They don't make any sense. So the first 2 years that I did comedy was pretty rough. And I felt confident on stage. I always had a confidence, but I didn't have the words, really. And it took about 2 years before I started honing in on, oh, I'm going to be doing this. I'm going to be sort of political. I'm going to talk about Muslims a little bit. And I'm going to find a way to sort of balance those two concepts and merge them. I became a very political comedian. And then probably took 8 years of doing it before I felt really confident in like who I am on stage. And it takes so long, man. It's crazy.
But, and obviously this is a big feature of your show this year. I think it's true, isn't it? A lot of people, when they're starting out doing comedy, late teens, early 20s, don't have that many life experiences. Now, in a way, comedy is sort of about life experiences.
Yes.
And therefore, you do see quite a lot of people here at The Fringe who are talking about very similar topics. Some of them find a really fantastic, innovative way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, your upbringing was not the same as everybody else's upbringing growing up, which you talk about a lot in your show.
Yes.
So I guess, how quickly did you realize that actually, because you had a very different experience of living in the US, that was something you could bring to the performance?
It took me a year of doing the open mics before one of my close friends, who's another comedian in Gainesville, told me, my friend Pablo, he said, you need to talk about being Muslim because it's fascinating to people. And I was uncomfortable with it because I didn't want to see, I talk about it in the show, I really didn't want to be a hacky Muslim ethnic comic who's, you know, Allah Akbar, blow stuff up. Like, I had that big fear going into it. But my friend Pablo was like, people are interested in this. They're interested that you're Muslim, that you're a redneck boy from the South, grew up very Muslim, and you're still praying, you're still Muslim, you have to find a way to talk about it. And that became sort of my journey over the next 10 years, decade of doing comedy, is how do you talk about it in a way that is true to yourself and also funny? How do you balance that? Because being funny requires a level of dishonesty, a level of, you know, flattening yourself to make a joke. And, you know, it wasn't easy to find that line. And it took 15 years, honestly, where I'm at now. I'm finally comfortable with how I talk about Islam and talk about being Muslim on stage. But those first few years, I was doing some of the Allah, 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 blow stuff up. Like, I was doing a little bit of that. And
I guess because, and you talk about this in the show, that did get a good response.
It got a huge response.
And ultimately, that you're looking for the laughs.
Literally. So you're bombing and bombing, trying different random. I mean, I remember my first joke ever was about Rosie O'Donnell, ironically. I just saw her last night. She's in town. And it was crazy to see her. And so my jokes in the beginning were completely non sequitur, unrelated, one liner, very Zach Galifianakis inspired. And, it just took time to figure out how to move away from that and into something kind of personal. But even when you do personal jokes, you're lying to yourself, you're lying to the crowd, and it's hard to figure out how to do that in a way that you can be comfortable with.
In addition to the stand-up, and we'll come back to this year's show in a moment, but I guess I know that you're also now doing other comedy stuff other than just performing on stage, and you're doing more writing stuff. So how did that side of what you're doing come about?
Well, that came because all my biggest heroes in comedy, when I would read about them and when I would listen to them on podcasts, they would always talk about how they were in writers' rooms when they were young, and they would write on different TV shows. I mean, Louis was one of my favorite guys in the world, and he was a big writer for Conan and for all these different shows. And so I said to myself, I should be a writer too. I need to get into a room. And when I was probably 23, I started submitting packets. I don't know if it's the same in the UK, probably not, because you guys don't have big writers' rooms. But in America,
who are the decision makers and then sending them your stuff?
Basically. Yes, basically you send the people that are making the shows packets of your material and your ideas, and then you hopefully get an interview and a job. And I was doing that for a year when I lived in LA the first time. I lived in LA when I was 23. And eventually I got, you know, I hooked somebody, Hassan Minhaj, And I wrote for his show Patriot Act for 2 years. And that was sort of that broke me into the writer world, where I'm still there.
Yeah. So you're still back in LA now.
Back in LA, writing a lot again and you know, making that money and sort of selling my soul a little bit. But luckily, I mean, the beauty of stand-up is that it's so detached from everything else that you can act, be an improv guy, you could be a clown guy, you can do writing. But then at the end of the day, you go, I have a spot. You can do your spot by yourself on stage with a crowd.
But I guess with writing for the big shows, although you are part of the corporate machine, I get the impression that
I'm a Netflix employee. I literally am currently.
But the room you're in, I sense, doesn't feel that way.
No. I mean, the rooms that you're in you're just with a bunch of other mentally ill writers and comedians. So it's a fun experience. Every room is different. Every room has a different culture and cadence and joke style, and you just have to kind of shift yourself to fit into it a little bit without completely changing yourself. So it's a different art, writing, than stand-up. Completely different.
So let's get very much to the present and talk about this year's show, which in essence, you've sort of given a little preview, because it is sort of your story growing up in Florida and then moving into comedy, and particularly about your father.
Yes.
And then you have sort of lots of...
I will say all the stand-up stuff in the show is only in the third portion. There's the first two portions of the show are very... I don't think they're like anything anyone's ever seen, I would say. I mean, the story is pretty crazy with my dad and with his car and stuff like that. And then we get into the comedy towards the end of
So it's your life story. You're right. Yes. A lot of it is growing up and your relationship with your father. And as I say, a very what's interesting life.
Yes.
I think interesting
is a political way to say it. Totally. Very interesting.
And the way you tell it is really compelling.
Thank you.
I was really drawn in. But I guess when did you decide, okay, I'm going to do an hour show.
Yeah.
I should tell that story as my show.
It was over COVID. During COVID, I mean, it was the worst. Obviously, it was the worst year for everybody. But it was for me. That's when my father passed away. I had just gotten married a second time, and it was very difficult on this new marriage. We got married, and then a month later, COVID started. So now we're locked down.
Yeah.
We're in New York. We're in one bedroom. It's a nightmare. And stand up went away. It was gone for about a year. And in that time, I just got it in my head, like, I need to find a way to tell my story of growing up and of my father's car and all these crazy things. And, you know, you have these stories as a comedian that you talk to people about you talk to other comics about stuff just all the time. And then you have these certain stories that you'll tell people and they'll go, that's insane. That's a ludicrous story. That's crazy. And you show them pictures but it's something that you can't talk about on stage when you're doing stand-up, because it's too complicated for stand-up. Stand-up requires a degree of simplicity and simplifying to make a joke make sense. But then with these stories, what are you going to do with them? And it was during that year that I decided I'm going to turn it into a show. And it also was a reaction to what I saw going on TikTok and Instagram during COVID, which now is just, that's just what the world is now. During COVID, you had this explosion of TikTok comedians and Instagram Reels comedians, people who made their living off of 1 minute long clips, whether it's talking to the camera clips or stand-up clips where they're just doing crowd work. It lasts 40 seconds, it gets one big laugh, and then it gets a million likes. And I saw this becoming the norm, and it kind of hurt me, because comedy to me is this real beautiful, fun thing that even like a small set, a 10-minute set, there's a bit of a story in it. There's a bit of a human in it. And when you do a clip, you're removing that.
Yeah.
These 1 minute clips
And I guess some of those comedians you name checked early, I mean, almost some of those were even from almost the Comedy Album era, where comedians treated it like an album.
David Cross. I mean, his album, you know, Bigger and Blacker, like, it was incredible. Like, all these guys, exactly, they were putting out these beautiful sort of soliloquy-esque shows that were fully, you're getting a glimpse into their brain. And watching what was happening with the clipification of comedy made me go, I want to make a show that is unclippable. A show that you can't take 2 seconds out of it, or a minute out of it, or you can't even take one joke out of context, because then you won't laugh, because you won't understand what it's connected. It has to be connected to the previous story. And I wanted to do that with this show, with Heavenly Baba. And I think I succeeded. I don't think there's any way to clip it.
Well, no, and I think that's the challenge, isn't it? When you do an hour, people can't laugh for an hour. And I think it's interesting when you see people who are doing sort of basically an hour of, you know, club style stand-up.
Sure.
Some people are really good at it.
Yeah.
But there is that, what I think of, the 40-minute lull.
Yes.
I can't laugh for more than 40 minutes. Whereas I think what the sort of show that you're doing, because you are really telling a story,
yeah,
is you can have some elements where you're not actually trying to make people laugh. You're telling, and there's some really quite sad moments in in your show.
Yeah.
But I guess, I suppose, as someone who is used to be set up punchline laugh, I guess that although it works really well, maybe initially that's a bit of a challenge.
Man.
5 minutes where I'm not really playing laughs.
Brutal. It was brutal for me because I am a club comic, essentially. That's what I've been doing for 15 years. And that's what I love. That's my favorite thing to do. More than this one-man show, if I'm being honest. I love just doing stand-up. It's free. It's fun. The jokes don't have to be connected. It's easy. I mean, I know I just said like I like to have a joke connected to the previous joke, but stand-up is just free thing. And so writing this show was a challenge because you have to lean into emotional moments. You have to lean into vulnerability. And I have a director, Greg Wallach, who his main job directing me was to go, it's okay that you're not getting a laugh. Calm down. Sit in that silence. It works. We enjoy it as an audience. We're not coming for a stand-up hour when we're coming to Heavenly Baba. When we're coming to your show, we're coming to see a story. You can be comfortable with the discomfort. You can be comfortable with the vulnerability because that's what we're really getting out of it. We're getting laughs too, but that's not all this is. And I mean, it was a learning process for me. It took like a year of me doing the show before I went, it's okay to have silence. It's okay to have, I mean, people cry at the show, you know, oftentimes people come and tell me they were crying at the very end. And that's not what I'm used to as a stand-up. So yeah, I just had to learn to get comfortable with that. And it wasn't easy. When I was first doing Heavenly Baba, it was 90% jokes with some pictures.
Oh, interesting. So it was a really evolved
over. It was mostly just jokes
because
that's where I came from. And after about a year of doing it, year and a half of doing it, I pulled as many jokes as I could out of it to keep the story as pure as it can be and then, you know, have injections of jokes when I need them, sort of.
Yeah. And when did you decide that you're going to do the Edinburgh Fringe run?
That was in December of last year. I mean, I had wanted to do it the year before, but I'm thankful that I didn't because I was not ready. The show wasn't ready. It had a lot of changes that needed to come to it. So yeah, it was December that I was talking to my agents and my team about, let's go to Scotland. Let's do this crazy thing. Everyone I know who I respect that's in this world says you got to do Fringe. So I did. Yeah, it was December.
And how are you finding? We're also halfway through, I guess.
I guess we're halfway through. Today's my one and only day off. It's a grind, man. It's a real grind to do it, to wake up every day and go, I have to do this again. At 6 o'clock, I have to go do this. It's beautiful because the show becomes like, it's so easy to perform. I don't even really get adrenaline when I go up to do it now after doing it 13 times or 12 times. Now I go up and I just know the show and I just can, whatever the audience is going to give me, I'm going to sort of give them a version of that back. And I'm not going up like, oh God, I have to make sure I remember this moment and I have to make sure that I nail this part. I'm like, I'm going to do it. I know how to do it. It's fine. It's a little boring, if I'm going to be completely honest. Doing it 12 times in a row, I'm like, I'm a little bored of doing this, honestly. And every day is the same. I wake up at 10, I go, I get to the gym, and then I have a sandwich, and then at 5, I go, all right, let's do the show.
Well, you are saying this, the famous week 2, everyone's sort of, rah.
Yeah.
The home straight will kick off in a few days. And in the final week, and it gets exciting.
I'm ready. I mean, today.
You just have to stay healthy this week. That's the challenge. The second week of the Fringe, challenge is to stay healthy.
Stay healthy. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can try that. I can try to do that. God, I'm lucky I don't drink because I've been seeing my friends getting wasted at night and having hangovers and stuff. And they're telling me that they're miserable. I wake up and I feel fine. This is all fine, man.
The pros of a sober Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah, no one talks about it.
Let's quickly talk about future.
Yeah.
So obviously you've been working on the show for quite a while now. You're doing the full run here. I mean, what is the plan for the show next? And then I guess just more generally, what's the plan with the stand-up and the...
Yeah, the show after Fringe, I mean, there are changes that I'm going to make to the show. Not huge changes. There's a couple chunks that I want to add to it. There's some tech stuff I'm going to alter. And then the hope is to... take it off Broadway in New York. I have a few theaters that are talking to me that I'd love to be performing, doing a little residency potentially. And then from there, potentially tape it hopefully for some sort of special or something like that when it's in better shape. It's good now, but it can be a little bit better. And that's the hope.
Well, I suppose, and here in Edinburgh, you're famously, you have your slot and you have to be off stage on time. Whereas
literally,
a New York show, you'd have a little bit more wiggle room to add some extra stuff.
Exactly. I think my ideal show is an hour 10.
Yeah.
And this one has to be, you know, 55 to 60 minutes. So there are little things that I'm like, I'm going to throw this in when I'm done with Fringe. I'm going to work on this moment and add this. There's a new character I have to add into it. But so that's going to be the next thing that I do. And then touring, and hopefully in the States. And then potentially, you know, try to shop it as a feature, as a little indie movie. I'd love to write something for it, because I do think it lends itself to like a, you know, Little Miss Sunshine, super bad kind of coming of age story that I think would do well. So that's the hope.
Well, that's exciting.
And then stand up, of course, the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And more of that writing in the writer's room.
More of that writing in the, yeah.
Taking the Netflix dollar.
Taking that beautiful Netflix dollar. I love that dollar. There's nothing wrong with it.
Well, let's wrap up by just doing the listings, the plugs for the Edinburgh run that is left. So
yes.
Day, venue, no, hang on, it's every day. Time, every venue, day. Etc.
Every day except for today, the 11th, my one day off. But it's at George Square Assembly Studio 5, which is right down there.
Right next to where we're recording this podcast.
Yep. It's at 6 p.m. every day. And 6 p.m. to around 7. And
where do people find you online?
They can find me on my Instagram, IsmaileComic. Or Ismailian on Twitter, or X, I suppose, and Ismail Bits on TikTok. That's where I'm at. And then my website, ismailutfi.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank
Have
you,
a good
man.
Rest of your Edinburgh run.
This is lovely. Thanks, man.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It, man.